This lecture, entitled Torah, the Lifeblood of the Exiled Nation, is dedicated to the memory and le'ilu nishmos, Mr. and Mrs. Max and Gertrude Goldberg, from Mordechai ben Ritzvi Gershon, the Gitl Bas Rav Yosef, aleihem ha'shalom, of blessed memory. Today, we live in a world which is, on the whole, very different from that of our ancestors. Jews today, even the most observant amongst them, are, more often than not, active members of general society and are well represented in virtually all fields. The constant fear of expulsion or attack, which is the lot of our ancestors and which was experienced in Europe in the last generation, is normally not part of our lives. And in addition, we as a whole have been blessed with material blessings that are historically unprecedented. It is no wonder that under such circumstances, the Jews in this country are thriving. What is truly amazing, however, is that throughout the many years of our Golus, our exile, often in very adverse circumstances, our ancestors also managed to thrive. Nations and whole empires rose and fell, but the Jewish community remained, in a certain sense, unaltered by either time or circumstance. In a sense, it is and was ageless. The secret of all this, I believe, was the love and respect that the Jewish community displayed towards the study of Torah. It occupied much of their lives, providing a healing balm for the many difficulties that they faced. In the words of David HaMelech, King David, this is taken from Psalms, this capital, this is Kufyotes 119, verse 92. Lule sarosho shashuoi ozovati boni. If your Torah had not been my delight, I would have perished in my affliction. For those who've tasted its sweet waters, it continues to have addictive properties, constantly drawing those that have imbibed its waters back for more. Without understanding the place of Torah study in the pre-modern world, it is impossible to fully appreciate their society and understand the major upheaval that was created within Jewry when the study of Torah was largely displaced as the major focus of their lives. Baruch Hashem, there are still many today from the study of Torah is no less important and is no less an anchor in their lives it was in the lives of our ancestors. However, this is no longer the case for the majority of Jewry. Coming lectures in this series will, Amir Tashem, focus on those forces that brought about this change. In this lecture, we'll focus upon life as it was lived in the ghetto or shtetl before those changes took place. We begin on page 1, paragraph A. Rabbi Nosson said, there's no love like the love of the Torah. Ein lecha ava k'avas haTorah. This idea expressed by Rabbi Nosson, one of the Tanoim, teachers of the Mishnah, was expressed time and again by David HaMelech, King David, in Psalms. As we read, this is a sampling. This is really taken from the first two verses of Psalms. Fortune is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of the sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the Torah of the Lord, and in his Torah does he meditate day and night. In paragraph C, we quote from Psalms 19. This is in the davening on Shabbos. To the chief musician, a psalm of David. And it continues on, the Torah of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, says, rejoicing the heart, Nisam Chelev. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The judgment of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold, sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. And finally, here in paragraph D, it says, Mo hafti sarasecha kol hayom hisichosi. Oh, how I love your Torah. It is my meditation, conversation, all the day. The Torah not only demands that we ourselves study Torah, but also that we pass it on to the next generation. As we read on the bottom of page one, this is from Parshas Veschanan. This is chapter 4, verse 9 in Deuteronomy. It says, only take heed to yourself and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. But teach them to your sons and to your sons' sons. Here we have, again, towards the end of Parshas Veschanan, this is from the Kriya Shema, from the Shema that we said. These words which I command you this day shall be in your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, which refers to your children, your students, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way, when you lie down and when you rise up. And in paragraph C, this is from the second paragraph of the Shema, you shall teach them to your children, speaking of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way, when you lie down and when you rise up. From what period of time and on did the study of Torah become a central feature of Jewish life? The Gemara points out that the study and teaching of Torah dates back from the time of Avraham Avinu, from our forefather Abraham, who received the Torah through prophecy and practiced it, although it wasn't yet commanded. He began an unbroken chain of transmission that remains with us till this day. And I'll just read from the beginning of this paragraph. You can on your own, you could read the rest. This is taken from the Gemara and Yuma Yoma, Chof Ches Amud Beis 28b. Chama Bar Chanina said, our ancestors were never left without the scholar's council, means yeshiva. In Egypt, they had the yeshiva, the scholar's council, as it says, go and gather the elders of Israel together. Understand, Zikanim refers to the leaders. The elders means the leaders of the community, means the learned of the community. In fact, the Gemara says, the Gemara in Kedushin, says actually the word Zokain is a contraction of Zekona, he who has acquired, because true acquisition is understood to be knowledge. So with the age comes the knowledge, but it's really the focus is on the knowledge. In the wilderness, they had the scholars council, the yeshiva, as it says, gather unto me 70 men of the elders of Israel. Again, the focus wasn't just age, it was wisdom, it was knowledge. Our father Avram was an elder and member of the yeshiva, the scholars council, as it says, and Avram was an elder, Zokain, well advanced in age. Our father Yitzhak was an elder and a member of the scholars council. And it goes on, you can read this. Basically, the thrust is that from the time of Avram and on, Torah was part of Jewish life. Josephus Flavius, the controversial historian who witnessed the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, the Second Temple, describes the connection of Torah to the Jews of his time. In other words, he lived circa the year 70, the year 100, in the following manner. Here's on page 3, paragraph E. Our principal, this is written in a book called Against Apion, which is really a fascinating book. There were anti-Semites of his time, in Josephus's time, and this was a work written as a defense of Jews and Judaism. And Apion was an anti-Semite, was an Egyptian priest who was an anti-Semite. So from the first citations taken, there are two parts to that his work. This is taken from paragraph 12 of part 1. Our principal care of all of this is to educate our children well. And we think it to be the most necessary business of our whole life to observe the laws that have been given us and to keep those rules of piety that have been delivered down to us. But notice the focus on education. And in paragraph F, this is taken from the second book, second part of the work against apium, paragraph 19. But for our people, if anybody but asks any of them about our laws, he will more readily tell him all than he will tell his own name. And this is in consequence of our having learned them as soon as we became sensible of anything, and of our having them, as it were, engraved on our souls. In paragraph G, I quote the words of a 12th century non-Jewish theologian, a disciple of the famous medieval philosopher Peter Abelard. He was the founder of the University of Paris. And he writes, as a result of a godly passion and love of Torah, do the Jews send their children to study in order that they know God's Torah. Even the poorest of the Jewish poor, who has 10 sons, will send them all away to study Torah. And not just the sons, but also the daughters are educated in Torah. During the pre-modern period, the constitution of the Jewish nation was the Shulchan Aruch. The code of Jewish law that was composed by Yosef Karo, together with the Haggos, glosses of Moshe Israelish. They are both largely based upon Talmudic law. In previous lectures, we have covered the lives of both Rabbi Yosef Karo and Rabbi Moshe Israelish. In this section, I would like to quote the pertinent laws of the Shulchan Aruch governing Jewish education. These were adhered to across the entire Jewish world, especially in the Ashkenazic world of Germany, Poland, Russia, and Hungary. To understand the Shulchan Aruch is to understand how life was lived almost without exception during the pre-modern era. And we'll start here again. This is section 3 on page 3, paragraph A. There is a positive commandment to teach one's son Torah. If the father hadn't taught him Torah, he himself is required to see to it that he becomes educated. This is taken from Shulchan Aruch Yoredeya, and this is Simon. This is chapter 245, and this is the first sif, the first paragraph. So it's 245.1. We now go to 245.3. This is in paragraph B. Just as there's a commandment to teach one's son, so too is there a command to teach one's son's son. As it says, and we quoted from this verse before, teach them to your sons and to your sons' sons. And this requirement is not limited to just your son's sons, but there's a commandment upon every scholar in Israel to teach students, for they too are considered to be akin to sons. One is required, however, to give preference to one's son over his son's son, give preference to one's son's son over one's neighbor's son. If you can't do everything, there's a thing of preference. Again, page 4 in paragraph C, then we cut again from the same from the Yoredeya. This is Resh Mem Hei 245, Sif Dalad. This is paragraph 4. One is required to hire a teacher for his son. He is not required, however, to shoulder the burden to hire a teacher for his neighbor's son. Now, there's a requirement to teach someone else's son is that if you have the ability, you teach for free, but it's not that you're required to on your own. As we're going to see, there is a rabbinic commandment, really, for a community to support communal education. In that sense, you're required to teach your neighbor's son. But as an individual, the Torah does not command that. Teach personally, but not necessarily pay. Now, the gloss is from the Shulchan, the body itself was written of the Shulchan Aruch by Rav Yosef Karo, who lived in Turkey and Eretz Yisrael. The glosses, who was a contemporary of Moshe Israelish, he was a chief rabbi of Krakow in Poland. If the person does not want to voluntarily hire a teacher for a son, then the community would force him to do so. I mean, again, assuming he has the ability. If he isn't present in the city and he has property, if it is all possible to inform him, we do so. Otherwise, we go down to his property and sell it in order that he hire a teacher for his son. Paragraph D. We quote here one of the commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch on Yoredeya is the Shach, Sifsei Kohen, written by Rav Shapsei Kohen. We have he lived between the years 1622 and 1663. He was a true prodigy, he was a true genius. And his commentary, both on Yoredeya and on Choshen Mishpat, two of the four sections, are not only classics, but they are the foundation of Halacha. From the Shulchan Aruch, when it's required to hire a teacher for a son, the Shabsi Kohen, the Shach comments, the Marshal, this was Shlomo Luria, who lived between 1510 and 1573, wrote that this requirement to hire a teacher also applies to one's son's son. This is quoted in the Parisha of Yeshua Falk. He lived between 1515 and 1614. The Kesev Mishnah, Rabbi Yosef Karo, the beginning of the first chapter of Hilchos Talmud Torah, wrote that it's quite possible this requirement of hiring a teacher applies to one's son's son and to a son's son's son as well. Now, this is not necessarily two generations. It's really, it keeps on going all generations. On paragraph E, we go back to the Shulchan Aruch, again, 245, and this is paragraph 5, Sif Hei. When does one begin to teach his son? One begins to teach him from the time he begins to speak. He begins with the verse, Moses commanded us, the Torah Tzivolonu Moshe, this is Morasha Kilus Yaakov, Moses commanded us a Torah, the inheritance of the congregation of Jacob. And the first verse of the section of Shema. This is taken from a Gemara in Sukkah. And afterwards, he should teach him a little at a time. This course is followed until the child is 6 or 7. At that time, the father should take him to a teacher of children. And continue on now. This is in Sivov in paragraph 6. This is paragraph F of our notes. If the custom of the city is that a teacher of children take a salary, then the father is required to pay for his education until he is able to read the entire written Torah, Tanakh. The father is not required to pay a teacher to teach a Mishnah or Gemara. This was only said when the father is unable to pay due to pressing financial difficulties. In other words, despite the fact he has pressing financial difficulties, he's still required to pay for a teacher for his son. If he is able, however, he's required to teach him Mishnah and Gemara, Halachas and Agadah, like everything. And again, you have to realize this was the constitution of the Jewish community, you know, in the pre-modern era. Page 5. Again, this is from, again, Resh Mem Hei. This is from Yoredei 245. Now this is paragraph 7. Sif Zion. We require to place teachers in every city. Now this is taken from the Gemara. This is a Takanos Chachamim. This is a rabbinic legislation. The inhabitants of any city which do not comply with this rule and do not have a teacher for their children are to be placed in cherem, excommunication, till they comply and place a teacher in their community. If they don't comply, then the city is to be destroyed by divine decree. For the world is sustained solely through the breath of the children who study in cheder, their teacher's school. So important it is that they should have that education for the children. And Sif Ches now, in paragraph 8 of the Shulchan Aruch there, 245. We allow children to enter school after their 5th birthday, but not before, because it's really too rigorous for them. If the child is weak, we enroll him after a 6th birthday, but not before. Then the Gloss writes, this is Ramal, nevertheless, as soon as he is 3 years old, we teach him the Aleph Beis, in order that he be prepared to read the Torah. That's why you go into these Jewish homes and on the cribs they have these Aleph-based charts. At this point, I would like to quote from the Machzor Vitri, a work that was written at the beginning of the 12th century. The Rav Simcha Vitri was a Talmud, was a disciple of Rashi. And he wrote, Machzor really is a siddur with commentary. And it's a classic. It's one of the earliest of the Siddurim that we have. Some of these customs, in a slightly different format, are observed to this day. When a person first brings in his child to study Torah, this is like he's like 3 years old, they write the letters of the Aleph Beis on a tablet for the child. He is first washed and clothed in clean clothing. They knead especially from 3 loaves, challahs made of fine flour and honey. A young girl is the one that does the kneading. They also cook for him 3 eggs and bring him apples and other varieties of fruits. They make a point of having a prestigious scholar escort him to the school. He covers the child with his cloak and brings him to the synagogue. The synagogue was where they had the cheder. They then feed him the loaves with honey together with the eggs and fruit. I mean, it's like for this little kid, it's a whole yontif. And then they read for him the letters of the Aleph Beis. Afterwards, they cover the letters with honey and tell him to lick them. Not long ago, I took one of my Enochos, one of my grandchildren, this was in Toronto, to his first, it was an upsharon, he had his haircut, and he went to the local cheder. And they had a whole ceremony, a little different, the whole ceremony with the kids there. And he put he had a whole thing of the Aleph Beis, and he put my ankle's allergic to, my grandson's allergic to honey, so they put jelly bellies. He put these little things on the thing, put them on, and he tells him, says, "Where's an Aleph?" And he grabs the jelly belly, puts them in his mouth. He puts on, "Where's a Zion?" You know? And that's the way it's a, and they danced, and it was like, it's a similar idea, that the beginning of the study of Torah really becomes very cautious. And then they all danced around in a, like, a train. And of course this 3-year-old was the shortest of the whole group, you know, as they're dancing around. Okay, and we continue on here. The child is then returned to his mother, still covered. When they start to teach him, at the beginning, the child is enticed to do so. Afterwards, the strap may be administered if he is lax. He begins his study with Torah Kohanim, the book of Leviticus, and we make him get into the habit of moving his body, shuckling, while he learns. Isn't that amazing? There's a great story, as an aside, that I read. It's Rav Yonis and Eibeshitz. Rav Yonis and Eibeshitz was one of the great geniuses, Torah scholars of the Gaonim in 18th century Europe. One of his positions was the chief rabbi of Metz, which was in Alsace, which, you know, at the time was an Ashkenazic, like a community, and they had yeshivas, and at a later time, the famed Shagas Aryeh was the rug there in Metz. And he had a very attractive personality, and he had a warm, semi-warm relationship with the bishop of Metz. And they were speaking about the Jewish community, and the Rav Yonis and Eibeshitz says, even if a non-Jew would study Torah, they tell quickly he's just not Jewish. And he says, it's impossible, the bishop said. How could you tell? And with this, what the bishop did is he took a non-Jewish child, evidently a very talented child, had him taught just the way that the Jewish kids were taught, their language, they're taught in Yiddish, with the same pronunciation. He got this child up to par as they were studying in the cheder. Then he placed the child in the cheder, and he already looked like a Jewish child. And Rabbi Yehuda Savchuk was invited to go to Cheder and to test the kids and to pick out which one was the non-Jewish child. As the story goes, he went through the test and Rabbi Yehuda Savchuk quickly picked him out. They asked him, how did you do it? Because he didn't shuckle. He didn't shake. You know, that much he wasn't taught. You know, it's like a cute little story. Okay, we continue on. When it gets to the verse, this is Leviticus 3:17, a perpetual chukas olam, a perpetual statute, he reads in the way it is recited publicly in the synagogue. Afterwards, a festive meal is made in his honor. So you should know that this initiation is considered as if he was brought before Mount Sinai, as is written in Scripture. This day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. It is not written that day, which would have been the norm. The Torah is telling us subtly that every day should be considered in your eyes as if the Torah was actually given in that same day. In other words, with the same excitement. This teaches you how to act towards your child when you bring him to study Torah. It should become exciting. You therefore pattern the event after the event of Mount Sinai. You cover him up like Moshe with the cloud and bring him up to receive the Torah. And we continue on with the Shulchan Aruch. Here again, this is chapter 245, paragraph 9. Reish Mem Hei Siv Tes. We don't remove a student from the classroom even if he is lacking comprehension and cannot read. Rather, he should sit with the others, for it is possible that over time he will catch on. Yeah. Paragraph J. The teacher should not hit the child as if he were his enemy, disciplining him with cruelty. He should not use a whip or a rod, but rather a small strap. Okay. The teacher should sit and teach them the entire day and part of the night in order to train them to study day and night.
And
this is from the time they're 5 or 6. You know, notice there was no gym, there was no basketball. They study the entire day and part of the night. This is from Sifas Yud Aleph. This is in paragraph 11. Paragraph 12, with the exception of late Friday afternoon and late afternoon of Erev Yontif, the day before a holiday, school children should not be released from their studies. This is standard. I'm just reminded of one of my sons, who was very aggravated that his sister, who was going to Beis Yaakov at the time, was let out that day because the boiler broke. And he was very angry that his sister has all the luck, that he wasn't let out. And in fact, says this was some time ago, he was crying that not only that, says the teachers hadn't struck all year. So it was just terrible. I would just end this section. I think from the Shulchan Aruch they had somewhat a different mindset. Yeah. And the top of page 7, we quote here from the Shulchan Aruch, we quoted before from Yoredeya. This is from Choshen Mishpat, which is really the laws of, it deals with all types of monetary requirements, interactions. And this is taken from a gloss, this is a Hagoah, a gloss of the Ramah. This is Simen Kuf Samach Gimel, Sif Gimel. This is chapter 163, paragraph 3. The gloss reads, in a place where the members of the city have contracted a teacher for their children and the parents are not in a financial position to personally compensate him, and the community needs to pay his wages, all of the members of the community are assessed in accordance with their wealth. Well, this is not just standard. Basically, it's a with the ability to pay, and that defines their requirements. Similarly, all of the members of the community are assessed when it comes to paying for a chazan, a cantor, and for the building of a synagogue. All of the needs of a community are treated in a similar manner, even though the taxpayer may not personally need them, such as a hall for weddings, or his kids, he doesn't, not a question of his marrying off his kids, or a mikveh, etc. Even so, they're required to pay their share. It's basically the similar, the property taxes, which pay for all kinds of city services, but not necessarily every individual needs all of the services that are offered. Not all Jews, however, lived in organized communities. Due to the difficulty of making a living and receiving rights of residence in an organized community, because the non-Jewish authorities didn't necessarily allow Jews to live in any particular community, and when they did, they may have limited it just to so many people. So it was very difficult in that time to get rights of residence. Many Jews, especially unlearned ones, opted to live in non-Jewish areas. But they still felt an obligation their children should be taught Torah. To that end, they hired tutors who would live with them, share their food, and educate their children. Solomon Shlomo Maimon, whom we quoted in a previous lecture, was a brilliant but eccentric scholar, a man who eventually abandoned his family and his faith and moved to Berlin to live amongst a circle of Jewish intelligentsia who were drawn to Moses Mendelssohn. In his autobiography, he describes his attempt at being a tutor in a remote village. And here from that we quote here on page 7 on section 4. My first position as a family tutor was an hour's distance from my home. The family was that of a miserable farmer in a still more miserable village. And my salary was 5 thalers in Polish money. The poverty, ignorance, and crudeness which prevailed in this house were indescribable. The farmer himself was a man about 50 years, the whole of whose face was overgrown with hair, ending in a dirty, thick beard as black as pitch. His language was a sort of muttering, intelligible only to the boors with whom he daily associated. Not only was he ignorant of Hebrew, but he could not speak a word of Yiddish. His only language was Russian, the common patois of the peasantry. His wife and children were of the same stamp. Their home was a hovel of smoke, black as coal within and without, with no chimney but merely a small aperture in the roof for the smoke. This opening was carefully closed as soon as the fire died down so that the heat might not escape. In this magnificent dwelling, the peasants sat on the bare ground. You dare not sit higher if you do not wish to be suffocated with the smoke. Here they guzzle their whiskey and make an uproar while the people of the house sit in a corner. I usually took my place behind the stove with my dirty, half-naked pupils and expounded to them out of an old, tattered Bible from Hebrew into Russian Yiddish. All this made such a splendid group as deserved to be sketched only by a Hogarth, this is William Hogarth, or to be sung only by a Butler. Samuel Butler was an English satirist. It may be easily imagined how wretched my condition here must have been. Brandy became my sole comfort and made me forget all my misery. To top it all, a regiment of Russians, who were then rioting with every conceivable cruelty on the estates of Prince Radzivill, was stationed in the village and its vicinity. The house was constantly full of drunken Russians who committed all sorts of excesses, hewed tables and benches to pieces, hurled glasses and bottles into the faces of their hosts, and so on. My other positions as tutor were more or less similar. The position may still be open, you know. Now, in regards to education, the community had two institutions. One was the cheder, the elementary school. A community institution was mandated by halacha, Jewish law, and was common in almost every community. There, the students were taught up until the age of 12 or 13, similar to the chadorim or yeshiva katanas of our communities. In addition, there existed another institution, the yeshiva. This did not exist in every community and was designed to educate those who had the ability to continue their intellectual growth through the study of Talmud and Shulchan Aruch. For those students who showed promise, it was a norm for them to leave home to travel to such institutions of higher learning. These institutions were often led by the great scholars of the generation, who frequently were also the rabbis of their respective communities. It was also quite common that a great scholar would make the community commit to finance such an institution of higher learning as part of his rabbinical contract. In other words, you want me as rabbi, you have to provide that there be yeshiva. If the community did agree to the rabbi's conditions, the members of the community would then be required to provide housing and food for the students, as these students would often be coming from far and wide, often from various countries, to sit at the feet and gain wisdom from a great scholar. In other words, in the period that we're speaking, the pre-modern period, there were no yeshiva dormitories. There were no yeshiva cooks. That deserves another lecture. Yeah. For those students who did not show promise, his parent, or the community as a whole, would see to it that the young man would now follow a path that would provide him with the requisite skills of earning an income. According to the Takanas, the special legislation of the city of Krakow, which was preserved in their pinkus, the record of the community's activities, a poor youth incapable of learning Talmud was to be given at age 14 to, quote, to a craft or to be a servant in someone's home, end quote. Now the Chadorim themselves were geared to produce students who would eventually become Talmidei Chachamim, Talmudic scholars. Those who showed less promise received the same education as a potential scholar. Although there were those that argued, especially the Maskilim, secular educators, that such students would have been better served had the curriculum focused more on the Hebrew language, Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, Hashkafa, Jewish philosophy and values, and practical halacha, similar to the education that girls today receive in a Beis Yaakov. Now, though such complaints against the cheder or yeshiva katana system of education are voiced even today, the truth is that history has shown that it is the study of Talmud and its magnetic attraction that has preserved Jewry throughout the ages and produced and continues to produce inspired scholars up to this, till this day, that continue to illuminate our communities. As we'll again discuss this topic in a future lecture, Mir Tashem, the various attempts at changing the focus of the traditional education have failed often miserably to produce similar results of a Jewry that is committed, you know, to live a life of Torah. You know, as an aside, really, there's a whole question about today's educational system. When I was growing up, the schools basically were still, up until graduating high school, were basically, the focus was on producing people who will go on to an academic career in college. It really did not focus on those who had special needs. Or at least only very, very minor part of the curriculum was set aside for those students. On that note, I would now like to quote from the writings of Rav Nosson Nota Hanover, one of the primary sources describing life in Poland right before Shnas Tach V'Tach, the years 1648 and 1649, in his word Yevein HaMetzula. In that work, Rav Hanover also describes in great detail the horrors, massacres, and wars that resulted in the destruction of a large part of Polish and Ukrainian Jewry during the Cossack uprisings of the years 1648 and 49. This is a subject that we covered in a previous lecture. Now I'd like to read from this here on page 8. This is again taken from Yevain HaMetzula from Nasa Nata Hanover. Poland, the pillar of wisdom. There is no need to offer proof for something that is common knowledge. He wrote this after the destruction of Polish Jewry, much of Polish Jewry before it was rebuilt again. There was never so much Torah learning throughout all of the diaspora of Israel as in the land of Poland. Every single community supported a yeshiva. They would give sufficient support to the Rosh Yeshiva, the dean of the yeshiva, so that he would be able to conduct the studies without financial worry, so the study of Torah would be his sole occupation. The Rosh Yeshiva would never leave his home throughout the year except to go to and from the Beis HaMedrash study hall or to the Beis HaKnesset synagogue. He would sit there day and night and would be involved only in Torah study. Every community would support Bochum, older students, and would provide them with a fixed weekly income so they would be able to study with the Rosh Yeshiva. They would also give each Bochur at least two boys, younger students, to teach in order to articulate the Gefes, means Gemara, Pirish, the commentary, and Tosfos, that he studied in order to become accustomed to Pilpul. They would give the boys food from the charity fund, from a special food collection. If the community consists of 50 householders, balabatim, they would support at least 30 Bochurim and boys. One Bochur with two boys would stay at the home of a householder. At the very least, the Bochur would eat on a regular basis at his table like one of his family. Even though the Bochur had sufficient stipend from the community, the householder would, as a rule, not charge him for the food and drink that he needed. Some of the generous householders would treat the boys like members of the family and provide all three of them, in other words, the older Bochur and the two younger Bochur, with food and drink throughout the year. And continue on paragraph B. There's almost no home in all of Poland where Torah was not learned. Either the householder was a scholar, or a son or son-in-law were scholars, or a Bochur was a member of his household. Sometimes all of the above together existed in one house. They fulfilled all three things that Rava stated in the second chapter of the Tractate Shabbos. Rava said, he who has a compassion for rabbis will have children that will become rabbis. He who honors rabbis will have sons-in-law as rabbis. He who is in awe of rabbis will himself become a rabbi. This is why there are many scholars in every single community. Community of 50 householder balabatim, there were 20 scholars who had the title Morenu or Chover. The Rosh Yeshiva towered above them, and all of the scholars were subservient to him and would go to him to study in the yeshiva. Paragraph C on page 9. In every community, the Rosh Yeshiva was highly honored. Whether one was rich or poor, his words were followed, and no one dared to oppose him. Figuratively, no one lifted his hand or foot without his permission. What he decreed became law. He had the power to inflict corporal punishment, to fine and publicly shame those who violated the law, and to institute legislation in order to ensure the moral integrity of the community. Despite all of this, they loved the Rosh Yeshiva. If one would have a choice piece of food, such as chicken, he would give half or all of it away to the Rosh Yeshiva. They would constantly honor him with other gifts, such as money, silver, gold, specially fed cattle, or fowl, or fish of superior quality. Also in the synagogue, most of the people who purchased mitzvahs would honor the Rosh Yeshiva with the mitzvah. The Rosh Yeshiva had the chiyuv, the automatic right to shlishi, the third aliyah on Shabbos, and at least the first day of Yom Tov. If the Rosh Yeshiva was a kohen or levi, his chiyuv, was the aliyah of kohen, his requirement of kohen, or levi, or achron, and he had the right to it. This was the case even though there were many Kehanim or Leviim in the synagogue, they all deferred to the Rosh Yeshiva. And we continue on in paragraph D, on page 9. No one left the synagogue on Shabbos or Yom Tov until the Rosh Yeshiva first departed, followed by the student body of his yeshiva. Afterwards, the rest of the community would leave and would escort him all the way to his house. At the onset of Yom Tov, everyone would walk over to his house in order to welcome the approach of the holiday. The great honor afforded the Rosh Yeshiva would serve as an incentive for all of the scholars who would constantly devote themselves to study so that they too would reach such a level as to be appointed a Rosh Yeshiva in some community. As the Talmud points out, the observance and study of Torah for an ulterior motive will eventually lead to the observance and study for its own sake. Through this, the whole country became filled with the knowledge of the Torah. Here, on top of page 10, no man left in the morning to his business without hearing words of Torah delivered by a scholar. Whether it be Rashi's commentary to the Torah, or prophets, or holy writings, or Mishnayos, or practical halacha, as they instituted in all of the shuls, and all of the synagogues. Besides, we're thinking about the yeshivas, and that learning was really part of the their life. Each one studied according to the desire of his heart. It would seem from Rav Hanover's writings that in his time in Poland, the yeshiva of higher learning existed in virtually every large community where the Rosh Yeshiva was specifically dedicated to educating his students. It seems, though, that he may well have had the additional responsibility of being the Av Beis Din, the head of the rabbinic court and chief rabbi of the city, issuing legislation and punishing wrongdoers, as Rav Hanover wrote. Now, regarding community support of a Rosh Yeshiva, the Ramah, the Moshe Israelish, in Shulchan Aruch Yoreh Deah, Simon Reish Mem Vav, writes, it's on page 10, paragraph F, there are those that are even more lenient and allow a scholar and his disciples to receive provisions from donors in order to strengthen the hands of those who study Torah. For through this, they would be able to study Torah in relative comfort. Nevertheless, it is an act of piety and a God-given gift for a person to support himself sufficiently and, at the same time, be involved in Torah study. This is not, however, something to be achieved by the common man, as impossible for every person to be involved and excel in Torah study while making a living at the same time. And it continues on, all of this is allowed if one takes a stipend from the community or receives provisions from donors on a set and constant basis. One should not, however, receive presents from people. That which is stated in Ksubas is 105b. One who brings a gift to a scholar is considered as if he offered first fruits, bikurim. That statement is referring to a small gift, as it is customary to bring a small gift to a prestigious person, even if the person be unlearned, but just to give as a sign of respect. The Shach, Shav Sekoyan, the Sif Sekoyan, takes issue with the Ramah in this. And he writes, from the Kesev Mishnah, it would seem, that it is even permitted to receive gifts. The Marshal understands this similarly, for there is no clarity in the matter. He was scrupulous not to take as allowed to be scrupulous, but nevertheless, it is not forbidden, for it does not say in Scripture, there's a verse in Mishlei. This is chapter 15, verse 27. Soina matonas yichya. He who despises gifts will live. So, but it doesn't say a taker of gifts will die. The Bach also elaborates on this matter and states that the Rosh Yeshiva Av Beis Din, the head of a Jewish court of law, is allowed to take gifts to the extent that he would become wealthy. For he is akin to the Nosi. This is the king or the president of the Sanhedrin, or Kohen Gadol, a high priest. And the Nasi is responsive. This is the common custom. So the common custom is to allow them to take gifts. I just quoted, there's a tshuva from the Ponim Meiris. that also supports the position of the Shah about taking gifts. So you see that if so, there was a situation here. You see the honor that was given to the Rosh Yeshiva and the importance of the study of Torah. And this is really up until the mid-1700s, this was the norm within Jewish communities. Yeah. So particularly Poland had this, he lived in Poland. Despite its many successes, the traditional educational system had its critics among some of the greatest rabbinic scholars of the time. Theirs, however, was a minority viewpoint, and during this pre-modern period, it doesn't seem that any of the proposed changes that they offered were ever implemented. Among the most famous were the criticisms of the famed Maharal of Prague, whose life we covered in a previous lecture. He criticized the study in depth that was common during that period and beyond. As soon as the student developed familiarity with the language and approach of the Talmud, he would supplement his study of the text of the Talmud and Rashi's commentary with the very difficult analytical commentaries of the Tosfos, the additional commentaries offered by the French and German scholars of the 12th and 13th centuries. Because of the time devoted to the analysis of the text, it was not possible for students to cover much ground and acquire broad knowledge. The Maharal bemoaned this fact and suggested that students spend less time devoted to analytical study and more time covering ground and becoming knowledgeable in the various tractates of the Talmud together with the final halachic ruling. Had they followed such a course of study, in the words of the Maharal, "Ein sofek klal shoy regilim v'yoidin kama v'chama mesichtois," there's no doubt that they would be familiar and know an abundant number of tractates of the Talmud before they got married. Now, however, they don't possess anything.
And marriage age then
was young. Here on page 11, here he says in paragraph A, I produced the original critique of the Maharal in the original Hebrew. It's taken from the Sivas Olam, the Siv HaTorah, Perikei, the chapter 5. Rabbi Tzalo, the brother of the Maharal, however, expressed his feelings regarding limitations of the educational system, which focused solely upon the study of Talmud in the following manner. And he writes, "This bitter and long Golus exile is what forced them, for they were unable to teach their children all of the areas of wisdom." Now, he recognizes the limitation of the educational system. "Therefore, our holy forefathers saw, especially the Hasidei Ashkenaz," these were the pious of Germany, like starting from the 12th, 13th century, "to only attract their children to the study of Talmud, to accustom them and to initiate them to this holy work. For in it lies wisdom and the fear of God all in one place. It's a true bread and sustenance and affords us the protection to live amongst the Gentiles." Others pointed out the lack of humility and spirituality in many of the alumni of the yeshiva system, a subject that was later addressed by the Hasidic movement in the Ukraine and Poland, and the Musar movement in Lithuania. Rav Yaakov Yosef, the Magid, the preacher of Polnoya, one of the earliest disseminators of the Hasidic doctrine, expressed his criticism in the following manner. This is the bottom of page 11. Again, he reads a homiletical interpretation into this verse of Malachi, referring to what when Eliyahu Novi will come, the Heshev Lev Ovos Al Bonin, he returns the heart of the fathers to the children, and he interprets this. Initially, he will turn the heart of the fathers to his children, because the Torah scholars, who referred to as fathers, will forsake the hatred which they harbor in their hearts for the children, quote-unquote children, which refers to the masses. Through this, he will turn the hearts of the masses, lebonim alavoysam, the hearts of the masses to their quote-unquote fathers, which means the Torah scholars. For there will be a unity in the Jewish world, as it is stated, just as water reflects the image of one's face, so too does the heart reflect the feelings of the other one's heart. In other words, he was bemoaning the fact that there was really a split, a schism, between those who were privileged to be scholars and those who were not. And he felt that there was an arrogance, a coldness that the scholars projected to the non-scholars. The Misnagdim, the foes of the Hasidic movement, led by the famed Gaon of Vilna, took great exception to his attitude towards scholars, and in fact had his sefer publicly burned. This we covered in a previous lecture. The Moshe Chaim Lutzato, the famed author of the Mesilas Yeshorim, one of the great luminaries of the 18th century, expressed his concerns regarding the lack of true piety and spirituality of the learned scholars of the yeshivas in a letter that he wrote to his Rebbe, Yishai Basan, that we quote on page 12, on the last page. "Behold, the German Jews are perfect in their loyalty to Torah and are plentiful. Thank God, in Frankfurt alone, there are about 300 Torah scholars, members of the yeshiva. They have a tremendous intellectual capacity to discern and understand, but behold, they waste their days in their pilpulim, casuistry or sophistry, and have not even the scent of Hasidus piety. Would it be that it was the only problem? If one would calculate the number of people in all of Germany, in which I traveled, and all of Holland, in which I now reside, who are fervent in fulfilling God's commandments and desire to know how to fear Hashem and to love Him and to create a close relationship to their Creator, surely a child could write them down. Regarding Italy, you, His Torah Excellency, already know more than I. At this time, there's no one of intelligence who seeks out God. Only void, chaos, and darkness rule over the city. They don't even understand or grasp the meaning of the verse, quote, 'What does Hashem ask of you? Only to fear Him.' End quote. Behold, it is for such a thing that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai protested," and he screeched like a crane, "Woe is it for the members of the world whose heart is closed and eyes are shut. All flesh are like grass and all of its kindness is like sprouts of the field. No one amongst them give any direction. They merely cry out like dogs, 'Give us, give us.'" And he wrote this in the year 1735. Moshe Chaim Lutzato to his Rebbe. Well, of the people, the focus was not on Yiras Shamayim. It was on pilpul, on intellectual excellence, but they didn't put focus on how to become spiritual. And it was really this lack of spirituality that he was alarmed on. This is really what Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, the Polnoyer of Magad, was concerned with. It was perhaps due at least partially to these factors that secularism made such inroads in Germany during the modern era. In other words, had they seen people of true spiritual greatness, people of spiritual love of God and of mankind, they perhaps wouldn't have been attracted to other streams of thought and in conclusion, I would like to quote from the Haggadah of Rabbi Marcus Lehman, one of the leading rabbinic personalities of the mid to late 19th century. He offered yet another reason as to why the advent of the modern era witnessed such changes in the traditional love of Torah and spirituality that had been previously so deeply planted within the hearts of Ashkenazic Jewry. And I quote, "About two centuries ago, the study of the Talmud blossomed amongst German Jewry as perhaps never before." This is referring to the 1600s. The communities of Germany, both large and small, were distinguished for their deep and upright piety. Yeshivas were to be found in every city in which Jews dwelled. Prague, Fürth, Frankfurt on Main, Mainz, Worms, Mannheim, Karlsruhe, Berlin, Breslau, Frankfurt on Oder, Halberstadt, and innumerable smaller places in which youths eager for learning streamed from all parts of Germany. Then there arose an unholy dispute, which was directed particularly against the great Rav Yonis and Eibschitz. We touched upon this in a previous lecture. The damage caused by this dispute and the extent to which it contributed toward dissuading young people from studying Torah and demoralizing the ranks of the God-fearing cannot be adequately described. We still had an opportunity of hearing accounts of contemporaries who lived through the dispute. End quote. In the next lectures, I would like to go into further depth regarding the makeup of the pre-modern communities, their governance and structure, and also regarding the role of the court Jews, men of wealth, who made their living by supplying merchandise and or financial assistance to the various monarchs and aristocrats of pre-modern Europe. Now, are there any questions?
So, was this a perpetuation of what had come before, or was this a change and also just didn't work?
You're asking about the Yaakov Yosef touched upon, the disconnect between the unlearned and the learned. And it would seem, we went through that period, that there was great animosity between the learned and unlearned during the period circa the destruction of the Second Temple. It seems that that position is not necessarily unique. It was aggravated in the Second Temple period by the fact, because of the laws of Taurus, of ritual purity, those who were careful, the learned were careful not to make themselves ritually impure, would naturally avoid those who were not careful. And that it's aggravated that sense of separation. But what came out was, because it was really in a sense unique to the position of what had occurred during the end of the Second Temple period, of all of the disruptions, of all of the wars, that there developed a very large group of unlettered people. It was in a sense unique to Jewish history. In the succeeding centuries, it was to a great extent fixed as education became much more widespread. The Jewish communities were not being led by Jews who were irreligious, as it was during certain periods during the Second Temple period. So, really, you didn't have this problem. Like I said, describing Poland, everyone was learning. And Torah was very valued. And even to those who were unlearned, made sure that their child received tutors to learn. Then came, at least in some parts of Europe, after the Cossack rebellion, the uprising of Khmelnytsky, the Jews became not only, it seems like a third of European Jewry was killed. And soon afterwards, in 1666, you had the thing of the false Messiah of Shabtai Tzvi. And all of the hope, and then again the disappointment. And now after such pogroms, the Jews were in a desperately poor position and were forced to go far and wide to find means of giving a livelihood. Many Jews were outside of the regular community. The communities did not provide that education. So we find a greater schism between those who were educated and not educated. That was particular, really, to the Ukraine, some parts of Poland. In Lithuania, that was not the case. And I don't think in Germany that was the case. But there's a natural feeling. You have people that are learned and people that aren't learned in the sense of inferiority. The learned have to really make the effort. you know, the kiruv, the god mega. And that's really what the Hasidic movement wanted to create that effort that where it was lacking. But under circumstances that existed before the Khmelnytsky uprising, or in other, which were not affected by the Khmelnytsky uprising, the study of Torah was very valued, and I don't believe that schism really existed as it existed, he said, in the, you know, in the end of the temple, the Second Temple period. Yeah.
The monster of Vitri. What is that? Is that a sitter?
Yeah. Yeah, you're asking about, again, we're talking about Machzor Vitri. The Machzor Vitri is a combination sitter and running commentary of the sitter.
What does it mean, Machzor?
Well, the word Machzor, as you think, the word Machzor really means a cycle. And it really represents the cycle of the year. There's the weekday prayers, the Shabbos prayers, there's Yom Tov prayers. It just so happened that the it came about that the name for the particular sitter which we use for this Yom Tov or that Yom Tov we call Machzor. But really the term Machzor really means cycle. And the original Machzor was something which included the whole years. But
so it
was a sitter.
Even though it's called Machzor Vitri, but it's today what we would have called a sitter with commentary.
Right, but it's very inclusive. Mm-hmm. A good tevach.